Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Go to Cheeselandia.com to learn more, and if it's for you, sign up.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's January 19th, 2021, and I can't believe it's 2021. We're recording remotely still. I'm up in New England, and we've got some special guests from British Columbia in Canada. And one thing that we've noticed is that throughout the pandemic, we still have this amazing community of craft beer people. And this show in particular, we're going to dive more into the backstory of Canadian craft beer, and in particular with two really important personalities from that region in BC. So let's go around and introduce ourselves. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio. Brad?
Brad McQuay. I started back in 1984 as a my title was brewmaster trainee. I got lucky and managed to land a job working for a crazy Englishman named John Mitchell, who bucked all the laws against doing a small brewery or doing a brew pub, and managed to get it put through. And so he was one of the pioneers out here in the West Coast. And he started the first brewery called the Troller. Actually, it was the Troller Pub and the Horseshoe Bay Brewery, because at that time the federal laws prevented a brewery from being on the premise of the pub. So they had to have a roadway separate the two. And so John went on and did this, and he spent about 2 years doing this, and then he walked away from it. Eventually, he sold out. And the reason being was he wanted to do an in-house brew pub. He just did not like the idea of having this roadway separate the two. And part of it was because in the early days in the UK, the major breweries there, they owned their own pubs, and they did bulk beer delivery. They would actually deliver beer in tanks rather than kegs and then serve out of those tanks to the bar. So it saved, you know, a ton of money in kegging costs and that sort of thing. And so they would do this bulk beer delivery. And I think that's what in the back of John's mind was doing the same thing. Is, you know, in this brew pub, you could have a tank and you didn't have to keg your beer, so there's less handling and therefore fresher beer, let's say. And the laws just didn't allow it. So he pursued, and he was very persistent and actually had the federal laws changed to allow him to do that. And so he was the first one to open a in-house brew pub, at least the first one that I'm aware of. And that was in 1984, and that was spring of 1984, actually, in Victoria, where Joe is. And you would know Spinnaker's, right, Joe?
That's right, yep. Spinnaker's is a great spot to this day here in Victoria, BC.
It's still singing along after all these years. It's amazing.
And great, Brad, hold on. So, Joe, introduce yourself for the audience briefly.
Sure. My name's Joe Weeb. I call myself the Thirsty Writer. I wrote a book a few years back called Craft Beer Revolution, The Insider's Guide to BC Breweries. And, I'm based in Victoria, BC, and happy to be here today.
Great. And Rob, we have another guest, Rob.
Yes, good afternoon. It's Rob Liddle here, and I make my home in Vernon, British Columbia. That's about 6 hours from where we're doing the recording right now, and find ourselves here in Abbotsford. I'm here with Brad, and my connection to the scene is, I guess I started off in brewing, but somehow fell into the malting industry, and that's where I seem to be continuing to endeavor.
That's great. So we're going to bounce around a little bit, but Brad's taking us back to the 80s, which is a great place to start. I think that
most of us don't know really the history of Canada craft beer, and especially not about BC. So Brad, you started working in this brew pub, and just tell us how you kind of went from that and to having a manufacturing business.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a direct line. I'll go back a little bit further, Jimmy, because you know you have to ask the question. Okay, why? How did I get a job in a brew pub? You know, I mean, it's not a you know, a common job. Matter of fact, it would be a very unique job back then. And my history was I started brewing beer, home brewing beer, when I was about 14 or so. It's probably not socially correct to even talk about stuff like that. But back then, times were different. And I had a paper route, and I saved up my money, and I used to make beer. I never actually drank it. I think I was trying to make beer that I could drink. And anyway, I never did like beer that much. And I think it was because the beer was actually terrible or putrid, to be more honest. And I remember making a batch one time, and my parents had gone away on a holiday, and my grandmother was left to look after us. And I have two older sisters, and so my grandmother actually didn't live in the house, but she did show up every day. And my parents had an ensuite to their bedroom, and so what I did is I had my five-gallon fermenter. It was just a open-top plastic pail that I put a plastic sheet over, and I had it fermenting in her tub. Anyway, she found this, and she dumped it out. And you have to understand, they were very religious. I mean, my grandfather was a pastor of a church and that sort of thing. And so I was kind of doing the devil's business in their eyes. But anyway, I actually made beer to the point where it was somewhat drinkable. And I never liked it that much, but I was an entrepreneur. So I actually packaged it in champagne bottles or, you know, sparkling wine type bottles. And I would sell it to the kids in grade 10 for 50 cents a bottle. So I was entrepreneurial at a very young age. But that's where my interest in beer and you say brewing science or fermentation science started. And I eventually ended up going to university, but mostly studying pre-med stuff, because I worked as a paramedic for a while and that got me interested. But it turns out that the science that I was learning, the biochemistry, microbiology, is, you know, right up brewing alley. You know, I mean, it was fantastic having that kind of education. So when I got into brewing, everything started to make sense to me. As a matter of fact, it was way more interesting than the pre-med stuff. So that is how I actually got the job, is when I sent a resume in, I talked about home brewing, which didn't seem to interest them, but my understanding of the necessity of having sanitary conditions and, you know, the growth of bacteria and even my understanding of yeast metabolism and things like that was of interest. And so that's actually how I got my foot in the door. So that was kind of the backstory on up to the point where I did get this job.
Brad, since we're talking about like technology and manufacturing a little bit, what systems were in use then? You know, what kind of measuring equipment?
I was just going to get to that, Jimmy. on this particular system was because there wasn't really anybody at the time putting together turnkey packages, brewing system packages. It was bought out of the UK, and it was a company called SPR. SPR stood for, if memory serves me right, was Stainless Pipe and Repair. They were a company that serviced breweries in the UK, and they got on this thing about making these package breweries. And John had met with them in Ramsbottom in Lancashire and bought this kit, you might say, and had it shipped to Canada and had local people install it. And he had a couple of friends that were fairly knowledgeable, and they did the startup on it and that sort of thing. I didn't start at Spinnaker's on opening day. I started three or four months after, I think it was, they had started. So I wasn't there for the opening. But that's where that system came from. I think shortly after I got involved in this, you know, I became aware of others that were in the industry. And JB Northwest out of Portland, Oregon, came onto the scene late in the 80s there. I started recognizing them. And we used to see a lot of their stuff into California and things like that in those early days.
Yeah, that's great, man. I bet you use a lot of different tools.
Yeah, you do. But, you know, I ended up, I stayed at Spinnaker's for 6 years, developed a lot of the early recipes and that sort of thing. And, And because it was an English system, it was English style too, the brewing. It was very simple infusion, mash tun, electric fired brew kettle. And we used whole hops. We didn't get into pelletized hops. We used whole hops. And even raw materials back in those days were a challenge because there was no internet and there was no catalog. There was no craft brewers conference. There was, you were left to really your own devices to figure out where to find stuff. And so your networking comprised of phoning somebody else that, you know, might have been 1,000 miles away who had a brewery, and you'd ask him, and usually they didn't know either. So you eventually did find stuff, but it was not quick and easy. It was through networking and travel and that sort of thing. But
so earlier you said that, for example, to get Canadian malt, you would have had to buy a railroad car size.
That's what they were familiar with. I mean, you could get a bag malt, but they didn't necessarily have it on the dock waiting. Like they would do a bag run every now and then. And if you're lucky at the time, then you could get it. But they charged so much for it. And it was just, you know, they were somewhat rude because it was just a real bother for them for such a small order. And so that's, you know, one of the reasons why we end up going overseas is because they were, I don't know, they seemed just grateful to get the business, even though we were tiny. And I think they thought it was kind of fun. So, but we could get a lot more specialty malts that way too. In Canada, the specialty malts were very limited. I think we were getting Karistan malt out of, somewhere in southern Ontario there. I don't know if Rob, if you remember the plant that was made at. Oh, was Rob been, Rob, you got to introduce yourself. Oh, yeah. We already did.
Well, let Rob come on now. Let's get his take. We know he went to a brewing science school. Let's hear a little bit about his introduction to the industry and its early work with malt.
He's got to tell us about his dad, though, Jimmy. He's got to tell us about his dad.
Okay.
Oh, thanks, Jimmy. Yeah, I got I grew up in southern Ontario, just north of Toronto. First generation Canadian from an Austrian immigrant family, and sure enough, very strong-willed father, and he went on, had a bakery, one of those typical small-town bakeries that you would have known back in the day, and that's where I grew up, but I realized at a certain point that wasn't for me, so I moved on. With that, all that knowledge, of that knowledge, and went to University of Guelph. Got introduced to, I took food science. I didn't want to throw away everything I'd learned. Then ended up taking what we call the co-op program. So you're not just studying, you're actually being sent out to see what it's like in the real world. And my second job was with Molson, and they were at that time in Barrie, a place called Barrie, Ontario, an hour north of Toronto. And within a week or two, I realized, my God, this is very, very interesting, and kind of in keeping with what Brad talked about. You know, it's a place where there's a lot of science, engineering, and all these things going on. Lots of people. You realize that there's something to this brewing industry. So I stayed on the brewing track, finished up my education in Ontario, and then I've always dreamed of going to Europe and hanging out there and actually going to school there. So I guess it finally culminated. I put my application in for Weihenstephan in just outside of Munich, Germany. At that time, I was the very first Canadian to go there and to graduate.
What language was that course in, Rob?
Yeah, Brad, that was all done in German. And that was probably for me one of the biggest challenges. It wasn't just going there and, you know, doing it all in English. So that turned out to be one of the biggest challenges. And anybody knows anything about the German language, there's lots of dialects. And I just so happened to be brought up in a house where the dialect was spoken, and I never really paid a whole lot of attention to the written language, so that became a very big challenge. I understood everybody because it's in Bavaria, and it's that part of the world where let's say proper Germans have even trouble understanding them. But that aside, I was able to get through it, and I graduated. And it just from there, the door started to open. I knew at that point in time I'd want to come back to North America. I realized it wasn't. I've always thought a lot of Europe, but I realized, hey, there's going to be some nice challenges in North America. And this was 1991. I came back to Canada after graduating, hung out at home, and I guess within 2 weeks I got pretty antsy. And my grandfather had also immigrated to North America post World War II, and he made his home in Southern California. So I said, "Oh heck, I'm going to go down to Southern California." So I hopped in a car and then drove down on my own. And this is where Brad comes into the picture. I stopped in for a week at a friend's place in Denver, Colorado. And I was lying on his couch, and there's a phone call that went to a fellow by the name of Eric Warner, also very well known in the U.S. brewing industry. He's been around for a while, one of the pioneers. And Brad and Eric had a relationship back then. And there's this call. Hey, Eric, do you know of anybody that's interested in running a malt house in British Columbia? And well, from a Canadian perspective, when you hear about BC and you're in the, well, what we call the Midwest of Canada, my eyes lit up, and I certainly had an appreciation for the European Alps and all that. So I said, oh boy, I think things are falling into place. So there I was. I continued my journey down to LA. Initially, I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to backtrack back to the Toronto area. Well, that didn't even happen. I just kept driving straight up the coast. And I ended up in this city called Victoria. My sister was there at the time. And next thing you know, I was being interviewed by this guy by the name of Brad McQuay. And so he was my first interviewer.
Well, it was kind of comical in some ways because Rob had tentatively, and you can correct me, Rob, because I don't know if you had accepted the job in bigger Saskatchewan, but I think that was one of your choices. You had bigger Saskatchewan or you had British Columbia. And
yeah,
if anybody knows anything about Saskatchewan, you need a very good set of binoculars and lots of patience because you can takes 2 days for your dog to run away. It's that flat and that far. and I knew Rob, if he knew Eric, that meant these guys like hunting, fishing, climbing, stuff like that. And, you know, where this malting plant was going in, it would be a place to die for if you're interested in that sort of stuff. And so I had to paint that sort of picture for Rob because I was originally challenged with this project before I started Newlands up, because this was when I had started Newlands in the early 90s. We'd skip forward to Rob's time here is around 91, 92, something like that. But anyway, Rob, carry on.
Yeah. So I had my first interview with Brad in Victoria. That was my first time on the West Coast. And then I got, I guess Brad gave me the thumbs up, and then he sent me to this other guy who was the marketing manager for a craft brewery here in British Columbia called a craft brewery in Vernon, BC, called Okanagan Spring. And he gave me my second interview, and I guess he gave me a thumbs up, and then he sent me on to Vernon, BC, where I got to meet the local entrepreneur, also European immigrants.
Yeah.
And they
that's why you got the job, because you could speak German.
Part of the,
if they were part yelling the and swearing at you, you knew what they were saying. So I think that's what they
well,
liked.
Well, wait, before it stopped, who just cracked a beer? Was that Brad?
Sorry, yeah, me.
Sounded good. What is it? That's what I got to hear about.
Oh, okay. This is from a brewery on Vancouver Island, East Brewing Company. And it's a West Coast IPA, appropriately called Jet Fuel.
Right on.
All right. So, Rob, I'm going to jump to something I read about you after you got started. So what was the demand for local malt at that time? And I guess to this day, I want to jump ahead, you know, does BC take a lot of pride in its local ingredients?
Absolutely. And that, I would agree, that statement is pretty much right through North America. You've got this heightened awareness about local products, whether it's BC or in your part of the world. At that time, however, I would describe it as no demand. I could say vague interest. It was all about, in terms of marketing, it was all push. So the only way you could get people to take your product was really to spend a lot of time, invest the time with that potential client, get to understand what they were doing, and then build a relationship from there. If I could use the word, the push-pull concept, back then it was push. And then at a certain point in the industry, I saw there was a bit more of a switch. It just became a pull. And you just had to make a product, and it was automatically tried, or it was more accepted.
What I used to do, Rob, was I used to just recommend people give you a call, you know, and we would start up a new brewery. People would often ask where to buy malt, and I'd say, well, you know, give Rob a try, because there was also Breese malting around at that time too.
And, Brad. You mentioned a very important name in the industry, and it was one of the notes I jotted down, and it was right at the beginning. There was a gentleman by the name of Roger Breese, the Breese family running Breese malting, and every year in Toronto there is a brewing get together in January, and I attended that one, and I was introduced to Roger Breese, and I guess as a student or someone in their mid 20s, I guess we just chatted, and he looked at me and said, "So what are you planning on doing, Rob?" And I said, "Well, Roger, I'm, believe it or not, there's a malt plant opening up in Armstrong, British Columbia." And he looked at me a little bit longer and he said, "You're crazy." And that's Breese malting, and it still continues today. So that was a cute little aside from a story way back. And that was even more motivational to see it through. And the malting industry in North America is very concentrated. There really are only a few players. And I guess in my time, what's rather nice to see, I'm going to say, if our craft beer revolution is now 25 years old, after 25 years, we are now suddenly seeing craft malting. And as difficult as it is, we are seeing people people that are in the agricultural community in different capacities take on an interest and take on that challenge. So you're starting to see that more and more. Names that may not be well known, non-traditional names that have just come out of the woodwork.
That's great. And let's go to Joe. Let me get Joe in. So Joe, you know, this is your area. So tell us a little bit about British Columbia, the breweries, and what else might have been going on in the 90s.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the BC craft beer scene, I mean, back then in the 90s, we didn't even call it craft beer, of course, back then. Nobody really was yet. We were just all, it was all microbreweries and micro beer and so on. But in the 90s, I'd say the highlights would be a bit of a boom of new breweries opening in Vancouver, which is the biggest city here in BC. Continued growth in Victoria and in various other places around BC, spreading the gospel of micro beer. It was just this kind of growing awareness and growing, you know, buildup of interest in the community, and until things finally kind of reached ahead and exploded probably, you know, about 10 years ago and started to really go from there. I just wanted to jump in on the conversation that Rob was talking about with the craft malting and so on, because that's a topic I'd love to touch on if we have time today, because there's lots of lots of recent growth with farm-based breweries here in BC. We have several now that have opened up in recent years. And I know from talking to a lot of them that the idea of growing their own barley and either malting it themselves or getting a maltster to custom malt it for them is a really exciting part of that idea, and that consumers really are keen to taste those beers then too. So yeah,
that's a good segue, Joe. Back to Rob. So Rob, what are some malts that people are asking for now? You can go further with this current craft malting in your area.
Well, very good point. And I guess there are many types of malts that are being asked for by the industry or by the brewing industry. My recent understanding is that the trend these days is to is going a little bit away from using caramel malts. I found that kind of interesting, and that's just very, very recent. We're seeing probably more and more well-hopped beers, but with a lighter, less sweet profile. You know, if you could imagine a good Pilsner, but really well-hopped, like a nice West Coast IPA style. In terms of malts, generally just running through what I call the malt families, you've got your on the low color spectrum, you've got your Pilsner malt, and then you move into your pale malts. Then you might then go into your Vienna malt, light Munichs, Munich malts, and let's say dark Munichs. And then on the caramel side, again, you've got what differentiates the caramel malt from, let's say, those malts that I just mentioned is the what we call the starchy endosperm. It's basically glassy. It's turned into candy, and that's all related to processing and whether you're kilning or roasting and the temperatures that you're using. And those malts that I've just mentioned all have a different effect on what you have on your palate, what you taste in the beer on your palate. So not in addition to the brewing method and the brewing equipment that's chosen, you also have that malt, which is the big driver of the palate that you taste, whether it's dry or whether there's a bit of sweetness. And the other malts that are on the extreme end, you've got your chocolate malts, you've got your black malts, they basically look like coffee, used in very small quantities just to give that nice the hint of coffee-like toffee characters. And then there's another real oddball malt, and that kind of falls into I guess something I had some influence over. And while at my time at Gambrinus in the mid 90s, there was a period where he said, "Hey, we got to figure out another type of malt." At that time, we had the Pilsner, we had pale. Nobody knew what a Pilsner. Well, some people did, but it just wouldn't have worked at that time. We had wheat malt and some darker malts, Munich malts. And then looking at the literature, there was this type of malt that in the German literature and Belgian literature is referred to as brew malt. And on my sales trips into the San Francisco area, there's a fellow by the name of John Berardino, also a well-known brewer for the Gordon Biersch Group at that time. And we would always go on these nice tangents about malts that were not available. And he put the bug in my ear, and came back and did some work. And according to the literature, looked into the malt a little bit more and came up with what the North Americans refer to and know as honey malt.
I was going to bring that up, Rob. I was going to ask you to comment.
Yeah.
So that's where the name honey came from. There's a German magazine called Brauwelt, and they put out this little booklet every year, and they talk about raw ingredients. And again, all in German. And one of the descriptions for that particular malt was honey-like, but obviously in German. So I said, I'm not going to call this a brew malt. Nobody's going to, I'm going to get hounded with phone calls. And so I said, okay, let's just call it honey malt. And to my chagrin, That was in 95, 96. And that's when all the Americans started coming out with honey beer.
So there was some confusion.
Yeah. There was I'm going to jump with you. You guys have a lot to talk about, and I'm going to steer the ship just a little bit. But first, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
My name is Sarah Kim, and I'm from Austin, Texas. I'm a Cheeselandian because while life is great, cheese makes it better. Wisconsin cheese has proven time and time again to be a delicious expression of craft, hard work, and tradition. As a Cheeselandian, I am able to share a Gouda experience with fellow cheese and food lovers nationwide, as well as connect with cheese producers and cheesemongers, taking my love of cheese to another level. I invite you to join Cheeselandia because during these difficult times, it has been even more important to take it easy and get cheesy. The Cheeselandia community and events have been the glue helping to keep us together and connected, and I would love it if you would join me. And let's face it, if you hear the word cheese and get a little hungry, then you've found a place you can call home. To find out more about Cheeselandia, go to cheeselandia.com.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Become a member and support us at heritageradionetwork.org. So it's 2021, and we're talking about British Columbia craft beer with Rob Liddle, Brad McQuee, and Joe Wiebe. Brad, did I pronounce your name properly?
Close.
Say it again for me. Come on.
It's McQuee.
So what I'm getting to is you're a big story. I mean, honestly, you're part of the Koenig Brewing Systems, and you guys reached out to put the show together. And I'm getting schooled right now on British Columbia. I've never been to that part of the Northwest. You got a long background in craft beer. When did you start your manufacturing business? And then we're going to weigh in on how important that was to the development of craft beer. And it seems like you had your hands in making a lot of things happen because you were making the equipment.
Yeah. Part of it was I started as a brewer, you know, so I was brewing and, you know, involved intimately on the beer side of things. I was never a manufacturer. My background was biochemistry and microbiology, not welding. But it was in those days, though, that they're just, like I said, there was a company out of Portland that was making equipment, and there was a few others, but a lot of it looked like it was designed by, you know, maybe engineers or fabricators or something, not really built by anybody that brewed beer. And so that's how I got into it, actually. I got into the fabrication side because I wanted equipment that I would work on. So that's what I got into. And the other part of it was I did a lot of training. In the early days when we sold a system, it always came with training because hardly anybody knew how to, you know, really run a commercial sized brewery. And so I used to follow breweries out. So we would ship out breweries, and there was one stretch, and this was in the early 90s. And I should back up. This is, I started Newlands in February 1990. And Newland Systems was my company that built breweries and provided consulting services and did a bunch of things. But anyway, when we'd ship a brewery out, normally I would follow that brewery and be involved in the installation. Then it was the training and the commissioning of that brew house and also help them source out, as I said previously, the raw materials, whether it was malt. In other words, I would suggest they get a hold of Rob for malt, and maybe they would buy from him, maybe they wouldn't. But even yeast, something as simple as yeast was very difficult to get at the time. There was a couple of companies that started up with Y yeast and then White Labs, and then it became a little easier to get yeast. But in the early days, I used to bring what's called a lyophilized ampule from the UK, from a place called NCYC, which is the National Collection of Yeast Cultures. And I would aseptically break that open, and there's maybe a gram of a freeze-dried yeast in there, and then I would culture that up in my little lab and to pitching quantities, and that's really how we got our yeast. And today, you just open up a catalog and you order it. You just tell them how much, and they send it to you. But you know, we couldn't do it back in those days.
Yeah, well, you guys are pioneers, and I think that's important to keep going through these stories. So you open up Newland. And how many breweries were you working for, building systems the first few years? And what was it? Was there a typical size, or was everything custom?
Yeah, it wasn't so custom. And the reason why it wasn't so custom back in those days is because people weren't knowledgeable. Each of the manufacturers, because the number of manufacturers really grew throughout the 90s. In 1990, let's say there might have been three. And by 92, there was six. By 94, there might have been two dozen companies that were all saying they build brewing equipment. And, each one had their own kind of design on it. But the dollar figures were small. People didn't have big budgets in those days, or most people didn't. You know, the odd one would have a big budget, but most of those budgets were pretty small. And I'm talking, you know, a brewing system in the neighborhood of, say, 150 to 200,000 all in, all inclusive. You know, and that was kind of the norm back in those days. But we would do, everything accelerated in the early 90s from 91 to 95. 95, we were pushing out about four brew houses a month. So four breweries a month is what we were delivering in 95. And there was a lot of these, you know, there was a big growth back in those days. And, I was actively involved, not just in manufacturing, but in the brewing industry as well. Like we're not on video, but behind me, I've got a small poster that I've got framed. And it was from 1993 Great American Beer Festival. And all the judges for that event signed this poster. And I'm one of the judges. And so the first time I judged for the Great American Beer Festival, which is in Denver, was in 92. And so I've been actively involved on the beer side of this industry, not just the equipment side, for a long, long time. And it's been a lot of fun. It's been a real fun. But it was the tail end of the 90s when things started to taper off. Joe, when did you start getting involved, start getting interested in the brewing industry?
Well, it was the 90s when I started, you know, really checking it out and visiting breweries and talking to people. But I didn't really start writing about it actively until, you know, maybe like closer to 2006 or 7, somewhere around there kind of thing. But I had a question for you, Brad, about like we have so many equipment manufacturers right here in BC now. You know, we've got you guys, and I think there's Specific Mechanical here and on the island, and there's a few more. There's at least two more that I can think of, right? How many are there here in BC?
There's when DME went under, it spun off a number of ex-employees and that sort of thing. So there's another group locally here, and they're doing small-scale stuff. Because it's not that hard to build simple. The smaller equipment. So when you get into the bigger stuff, then you really need to be in the engineering side. So that has never bothered me. Competition has never been a concern of mine, whether it's on the beer side or whether it's on the equipment side. I just focus on my job and what I'm doing and how do I get better and how do I improve and not worry about what other people are doing. I mean, it's like driving a race and looking in your rearview mirror all the time. You should be looking down the road to try to win the race. So that's kind of my approach to it.
I've just always thought it was interesting that we had these, the conjunction of having these equipment manufacturers here in BC and the industry growing along with them. I mean, you describe how you provided services, like consulting services as well, and helped basically train a lot of these early brewers when they were opening their businesses. And I think that's a big reason for the success of the industry here in BC.
Well, in North America, yeah. Though, I used to take yeast with me. I used to pack it on a plane, and I used to get in trouble with customs because they wanted to put their fingers in it and all that sort of thing. You know, because think about it. You're getting on a plane, and you got this container, and it's got gooey stuff in there, and they have no idea what it is. You're trying to explain it's yeast slurry. It's not beer. It's not alcohol. No, honest, it's not going to blow up, you know. And prior to 9/11, you could do that. But after that, of course, that everything changed. But, I trained, probably over 1,000 brewers over the years. Because a lot of times it was more than one person what I'm dealing with. Sometimes it was three or four people that you're working with. And what I mean training is training them on the equipment. I'm not there for months on end to fully train these people out. I'm showing them, you know, the basics of brewing and that sort of thing. And you know, the rest of it they would pick up as time.
Hey, let's talk about it. Let me jump in about innovation. So in the time that you – from the time that you started Brad and Rob – so for Brad, for you, let's go to brewery systems and Rob, for you, malting or malting systems. What was the biggest change that happened, not just the scale, but was there a specific technological change or something that really marks the difference between, let's say, now and the 90s?
Well, there's a number of things. Let me deal with just the early 90s, the technological differences. And I'm comparing what we did with others more than anything else. Most of the systems were fairly simple, and Rob can attest to this, but most of them were also direct fired. Direct fired means they had a flame underneath a pot. In other words, your brew kettle was flame fired. And from the very beginning, I never liked it. I always went with steam, and we dabbled a little bit in direct fired, but never liked them, and they were never very efficient and things like that. And so we standardized on steam fired systems and have always done that. And so that doesn't equate to your question about innovation of today. Today, innovation is in all aspects.
But Brad, that was a huge moment. Thank you.
Oh, okay. We don't have enough time to get into all those moments, Jimmy.
We got more time than you think.
No, we'd have to. We'll have
direct fire to steam, and then
Direct fire to steam. But you fast forward how technology or how automation and everything else changes with time. Like PLCs and things like that were expensive, and really the domain of larger enterprises and things like that. You know, so small scale was a little unusual. It wasn't absolutely unique, but you just didn't see a lot of that today. Even simple systems will have a PLC running it, and some will say their system is automated, and it means they have a PLC. It doesn't really do anything. It just gives them some readouts on temperature and flow and stuff like that. It may not control the process at all, but you can find very small systems, and we built them where it is automatic. I mean, you can actually run it from your iPhone or iPad or your desktop even if you want. And that's the difference. But the difference also is the dollar value. You know, like we've done little tiny systems that are 800 to almost $1 million. And that was unheard of back in the 90s. I mean, just no one would spend that kind of money. And nowadays, that is not an unusual number. You know, when someone says, okay, my budget is, you know, $1.3 million for the brewing system. And you're going, yeah, that's reasonable.
Yeah, it's very different. And then, Rob, for you, let's pick one moment in your career where something major changed, the technology or some other aspect.
You know, and as Brad was speaking there, I was trying to think of a moment, or let's call it what's happened in the last 30 years. Malting is a very traditional industry, and the adoption of new techniques is very slow. And it really, you go through most of the malt plants anywhere in the world, if you did that, you'd recognize, my God, they all look the same. They all look roughly the same, only it's the scale. But if there's one overriding piece of technology, or I'm going to use the word understanding, that we have today that we didn't have 30 years ago, is the importance of in a nutshell, malting is it's a growth process. You actually are taking barley, harvested that's been harvested by farmers. You're steeping it, germinating it, and kilning it. So it's a biological process. And one thing that we understand now more than we did 30 years ago, and this is all work that's come through the brewing research, is the importance of the role of oxygen in the steeping and growing of our germination of barley. And what that really means, like 30 years ago, it wouldn't be unheard of that someone just takes barley and steeps it, because they put it in water and it absorbs the water. You come to a certain moisture content. But once it's at that magical point where it starts to germinate, well, it may have suffered through a lot. Like it, some people may not have even, you know, provided an air rest. These are all technical terms. It's about keeping that seed alive, never letting it feel like it's drowning. And believe it or not, that simple concept has spilled over and influenced beer production in the U.S., Canada, around the world. And we're the brewing industry and the malting industry is a better place for that. So,
well, the other thing, though, too, Rob, is back in, you know, the early days, we could measure oxygen in parts per million, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what are we measuring today?
PPBs.
Yes, parts per billion. So, and, you know, I'm waiting for the parts per trillion to come out next, but who knows?
Well, if you're in the States, they're giving out $1 trillion stimulus now. So we never really heard about trillions before.
Yeah, but it's becoming common.
And I just wanted to add, there just really hasn't been a magic bullet in the malting industry. It still involves a lot of work, a lot of hard work. It's what I call, it's the black box of the brewing industry. It's unknown. There's really only a handful of people that really know what's going on inside it. And they're all employed, and they're usually at one of the malt plants. And it's a unique animal. And I don't know how else to describe it.
You know, I'm definitely going to have you guys back on again, because Rob, I've always heard about Western Canada malt, and we're going to talk more about it. But let's get to Joe. So Joe, let's tell us about your book and about the BC Ale Trail, and kind of bring us up to speed on, you know, when COVID's over, you know, where should I be drinking in British Columbia?
Right where Joe is in Victoria.
Yeah, pretty much right, Brad. My book, Craft Beer Revolution, came out in the first edition was 2013 when we had 50 breweries in BC. I did a second edition a couple years later when there were 90 breweries. And then I basically gave up trying to update the book because we were opening 25 breweries a year. It was kind of impossible, but I helped start this other project called the BC Ale Trail. And that is a website, bcaletrail.ca, that, you know, provides all the info you need to explore the craft beer community here in BC from afar and to plan a trip, plan a visit. We, you know, I think Brad will agree with me when I say that I think we've had a world-class beer community here for a long time. It's just that people didn't necessarily know about it. And we've been trying to spread the word and to get the news out there and bring influencers and writers in here to taste the beer and to see how good it is. And to, you know, the great thing about BC is that it's basically the best place in Canada for so many reasons from a, you know, touristic standpoint. You know, we have amazing landscape, access to ocean and skiing and all kinds of different climates that you can experience, you know, all in one place. And you know, a lot of people move to BC because they, you know, from elsewhere in Canada, because it simply is the best part of Canada, bar none. So you get that, and then you have amazing beer in combination. So yeah, here in Victoria, we consider it, you know, I consider it kind of the cradle of the craft beer revolution. Spinnaker's, as we've talked about at the start of the interview today, was the first brew pub in Canada back in 1984. And it's still going strong today. Along with Spinnaker's, there's another 12 to 15 other breweries of various shapes and sizes, all kinds of different types of beer being produced here, and, you know, great different approaches, tap rooms and brew pubs and production sized breweries and so on. So,
hey, Joe,
Is
Swan's still open there?
Yeah, Swan's Brew Pub is still going strong as well, and they opened back in 1989. So that's kind of another very early historic brew pub to check out while you're here too. So
it was Paul and Sean Hoyne, and I think Sean's got his own brewery now, right?
Yeah, Sean Hoyne ended up moving on to another brew pub nearby called Canoe that's still going strong, yep. And then he opened Hoyne Brewing, which is his own spot about 10 years ago now. So. Yeah, you know, we've got lots of different places to visit here in BC. Victoria, of course, is my favorite, but since I live here, but I'd also highly recommend Vancouver. They've got a really dynamic, creative scene over there with more than 25 breweries spread all around the city, lots of different things going on. Just fantastic beers to taste there as well. And I mean, just everywhere you go, everywhere you look in BC, it's just been spreading all over the province. We have more than 200 breweries here now. So
now, Joe, what you need to do is rub the weather in right about now. Like, it's probably sunny. And
yeah,
what's the temperature there?
It is. It's sunny. It's a little on the cool side for Victoria. It's only about 5 or 6 degrees Celsius. Sorry, what's Fahrenheit for that? Jeez.
It's 42, 44, something like that.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, but it doesn't get much colder than this here in Victoria. And certainly, you know, just a couple days ago, I was out on my bike and I was wearing my long pants, but I was thinking, oh, I should just be wearing shorts. I'm too hot. So that'll tell you something. Mid-January.
And Joe, you're known on Instagram as @ThirstyWriter, and I'm going to keep following you. Definitely got a lot going on. So Brad, just to bring our listeners up to speed, some know about you. Some know that you at some point you sold your Newland Systems, and that business ended up closing after you sold it, and you've come back. So what's it like coming back? You know, I'm sure the industry welcomed you. You've been such a hero for so many years.
Well, you know, when I sold it, Jimmy, you know, when I sold the business, I was thinking that the business had grown really too big for me. You know, like I view myself as a hands-on type guy. And so when you have multiple locations and hundreds of employees and that sort of thing, it was getting a little big. And I probably didn't believe in myself to run it. And so I thought, well, you know, here's an opportunity to continue the business by selling it and providing opportunity for those that worked for me. And unfortunately, it just did not work out that way. And so during that time frame, it was about a 2-year sabbatical, you might say, I took from the industry. And that's when I realized I missed the manufacturing side. I missed doing the startups. Because even though I was the owner of the business, I still would do probably half a dozen startups a year. So I would go out and show up at the tail end of an install and work with the installation team to finish that off, and then do the commissioning and then do the training. I still like doing that. And I'm not a kid. I'm 64 now. And but I try to stay in shape and try to keep up with the younger guys. And we are in the beer industry, so that's also sometimes a difficult challenge too. But I've managed to stay fit enough anyway. But so after DME or the venture capital group that actually bought the business, I mean, they failed, and I was still the owner of the manufacturing facility. Like, I didn't sell that, and so I talked to a few employees and a few other people at the end. They were all wondering what to do, and I just felt kind of sorry for them all because I let them all down. You know, I sold the business thinking that it was going to grow and continue and provide opportunities, and here they're unemployed. So starting it up was a no-brainer. It really, it's something I've been doing for 30 years. So it's like going to the bank and they're saying, well, this is a new business. And I'm going, it's not a new business. It's a business I know real well. And they back me. I mean, the banks are no problem. They're on our side. And then the employees that we hired at the beginning here were all ex-Newlands employees. They were all experienced people. The engineering group I've got here is, I think the newest guy's probably got, you know, 5 or 6 years doing the breweries, but all of them worked for me before. So
I just saw on your Instagram, so at Koenig Brewing Systems, the latest post, it says big tanks. Now, those two big white tanks, how big are those?
I think those are 400, I think I'll measure that in metric. So I'll call those 400 hectoliter tanks, which is about 360 barrel, something like that.
So those are big tanks. Well, so,
not,
so much has changed.
We build bigger.
I'm not going to cut you off, but let's just wrap it up. So, you know, we're in COVID. A lot of things have changed. A lot of people have pivoted. If each of you can just say one thing about your area of expertise, what you can predict, and maybe in a positive predictions for 2021 and beyond. Let's take Joe first.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, I've been following and checking in with breweries all over the province all throughout the COVID times because, you know, I've been really worried that some of them would end up having to shut their businesses down. And so it's been really, really gratifying in a lot of ways to see them pivot and to see them respond. Of course, a lot of them have had to lay off some of their workforce, but they're all hoping to come back stronger. And the message I keep hearing repeated is that it's giving them an opportunity to assess their business model and to recognize parts of their business that maybe they weren't doing as well as they could. And whether that's packaging, a lot of breweries weren't bothering to package or were doing it on a very limited basis because they were relying solely on their tasting rooms. So now those breweries have recognized the importance of balancing their business model so that they have, you know, they can rely on their tasting rooms for part of it, but that they also have a packaging model in place and then a distribution point. As a consumer, I've been really happy to see a lot of breweries add shipping through Canada Post or couriers to their distribution models because just the way the BC is kind of set up, if you live here, like in Victoria, you're on an island that's separate from the mainland, and it means that a lot of the smaller breweries don't bother to distribute their beer here because of additional costs of getting it over here on the ferries and so on. So if I want to taste beer from a really cool brewery that doesn't normally distribute here, and I'm landlocked here on the island because of COVID, I'm kind of hooped. But, you know, luckily some of them are starting to ship through Canada Post, as I mentioned, and so on. And it gives me the opportunity to occasionally put it on order for something special.
So, that's great.
Yeah. So I think that's what I'm most excited about is just to see them all as they come out of COVID, to see them all adjust their models and really fine tune what they're doing so that they can really do the best they can.
And great. And Rob, for you, World of Malt in 2021.
Well, I know that the malting industry as a whole has taken a hit, i.e. whatever happened to beer consumption has a very direct effect on the amount of barley being used and i.e. the amount of barley being processed into malted product. And I think we're in a phase now where as people sort through let's call it chaos. There will be more beer consumed, and I would say predominantly draft. I think that's what's had the biggest influence. The drop in draft consumption has had the biggest influence on beer volume, therefore the effect on malt being sold. But I have a feeling that's all going to change. And if history is anything, history is something to look at and learn from. I understand there was a pandemic 100 years ago. It was just after the First World War. Also really bad Spanish flu. And people got, well, our societies got through that. And then all of a sudden there was a thing called the Roaring Twenties.
You're like me, Rob. I'm positive and an optimist, and I'm right there with you. And Brad, let's close it out. And again, if tell me your beers. I know you had the Ace, Rob, and Joe. Before we go, just quickly mention any beer that you're drinking. But Brad,
Blue Buck. I'm drinking Blue Buck because it's one of the only vertically integrated breweries in North America. It's a craft brewery located right in Joe's neighborhood. They built a malt plant. Not only do they make beer, they make malt. And there's only one other one in Western Canada, just outside of Calgary, called Origin. I have to put a plug in for them.
All right, Blue Buck. Joe, what are you drinking?
I'm not drinking anything right at the moment, actually, because I was in the middle of my work day. But let me think. What do I want to have? There's a great local brewery called Category 12 that I'm a big fan of. And they've got a really nice Imperial Hazy IPA called High Frequency that I've been enjoying a lot lately. So that's what I'll reach for later, for sure.
That's great. So, Brad, let's close it out. So
All right.
It's your show. You're the man. And I appreciate you guys coming on.
Well, everything looks rosy. Let's put it that way. Even though the COVID is not over yet, vaccine is slowly making its way out to the population. People are anticipating the end. Wrong or rightly, I don't have a crystal ball, but we've become accustomed to the situation we're in right now, and we're seeing expansion. We're seeing orders being placed on a regular basis. We're busy. We're looking at adding a second shift here, and that was not something that was happening a year ago. So That's a telltale sign right there for everybody, you know, that guess what? People are believing that there is a need to add more equipment to make more beer. So I think people are anticipating a very good summer.
Well, you guys just picked me up. That's what I think too. So thank you guys so much. I'm sure we'll get to talk again. Joe, I think you're going to need to do a long form book with Brad and get all of his particularly interesting moments from his career.
Agreed.
I'll just let him talk and I'll type it. He's just a great storyteller.
Yeah, we could keep going. So thank you so much. Big thanks, Rob, Brad, and Joe for joining me on Heritage Radio Network. Big thanks to our engineer, Armin, and intern, Caroline Fox. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, guys. Woo!
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.